great to see so many people here at Santi, and for a little talk this evening, I'd like to talk a little bit about the forest tradition. Okay, so here we are in the forest, and when you look at what Buddhism is supposed to be in the descriptions of Buddhism, they say there's Mahayana Buddhism and Theravada Buddhism and Vajrayana Buddhism and so on and so forth, none of which the Buddha had ever heard of, right? So if you ask the Buddha, are you a Mahayanist or a Theravadan, he'd say, I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. Could you please explain it to me? What are these foreign, unfamiliar concepts that you're talking about? But the Buddha lived in the forest. Yeah, he was a forest monk. Yeah. And so this is, my experience of Buddhism is also very much tied up with my experience of living in nature as someone who's, you know, born and brought up in the city. And my main experience of being in the forest has been my Buddhist experience. When I wake up in the morning, you look out the window and what is there? Yeah. There's no big sign saying you are a Theravadan, you are a Mahayanist or anything. There's trees. So this is the kind of Buddhism that I can identify with if I'm going to identify with anything. And of course the idea of living in the forest is not about a particular doctrine, although it relates to Buddhist doctrine, no doubt about that. It's not a particular spiritual practice as such. There's plenty of people who live in the forest without doing any spiritual practice. But it relates to the practice that we do. So I'd like to talk a bit about this idea of the forest tradition and why we live in the forest and what we're doing here. And it relates to everything, the forest from the enlightenment tree that the Buddha got enlightened under, was a tree, but also it's the tree which can fall on your heart in the middle of the night. It's also as part of the experience of living in the forest. And this happens too, yeah? The forest is not just an ideal, right? We can paint a picture of the Buddha living or sitting meditating under the Bodhi tree. And it's a very idealized portrait of living in the forest. People, when they paint the portrait of the Buddha living, sitting under the Bodhi tree and meditating, they don't paint the ants, yeah? But I guarantee you there were ants there, all right? They don't paint the mosquitoes. Yeah, that's what I'd like to see, is a portrait of the Buddha getting enlightened and some mosquitoes on his arm. Yeah, he's completely ignoring them and just meditating. Because this is the reality, yeah, living in the forest. So, first up, a bit of history. And of course, as I just mentioned, the Buddha very famously became enlightened under the Bodhi tree. He was also born in the forest. In the sal grove in Lumbini. He passed away in another sal grove in Kusinara, in between two sal trees, and spent much of his life living in the forest, wandering from place to place. Now, at that time in India, 500 BC, around the Ganges Valley was the area that the Buddha lived, sort of central north India. And at that time, even if you go there today, you'll see that the soil is very rich in that area. It's very fertile. So in those times, most of the area would have been quite magnificent forests. And the texts speak of lions, bears, elephants, tigers, and all of the other kind of beasts that would normally inherit those kind of areas. So when the Buddha, of course, born in the forest and then grew up in an educated, upper-class family, and then when he wanted to take up his spiritual practice, he left that and went into the forest. Now, that's a very decisive moment, okay? Leaving the city, going into the forest. Now, you think about that just for a moment. What are you leaving behind? Yeah? Well, leaving behind family, leaving behind friends, leaving behind comfort, leaving behind stability, leaving behind order, leaving behind a career, a life, all of those things. And if we think about what, how do we make cities and towns? Well, you look at this room that we have around us. Well, it's made in the shape of a rectangle. Yeah? It's got right angles. You go into the forest, you try to find a right angle. Yeah? Right angles don't exist anymore in the forest. Yeah? So we create, when we build structures, we build an environment, we create it with this kind of sense of order and structure, which is something that's very human. It's a product of culture, straight lines, right angles. We make the floor nice and flat and even. We moderate the temperature. It's not too cold in the winter. It's not too hot in the summer. We protect ourselves from the beasts and all of those kinds of things. This is what we call civilization. So when we take that step from so-called civilization into the forest, we're leaving behind all of that structure. Yeah? We're leaving behind all of the things that have given a semblance of order and regularity to our life. And we've stepped into that world where everything is uncertain, where we don't know what is behind the next tree. We don't know what is in the next shadow. That world where things are not constructed by human ideas, but where things grow according to nature, that the wilderness. And because we're surrounded by these very primeval forces, then this is a place where the unconscious can go wild. A place where your hidden fears start to manifest. And the Buddha talked about this in his practice when he would be sitting alone in the forest in the middle of the night, and then he would hear a noise in the forest, and he's thinking, what's that? Yeah? So when you go back to your huts or whatever tonight, yeah, you can do the same practice that the Buddha did. Yeah, you can sit there thinking, oh my God, is that a tiger? Is it an elephant? Is it a ghost? Or is it just a wombat? Yeah? So the Buddha, you know, he was like, is it a tiger or what is it stalking me? And then he realized, oh, it's just a peacock in the bush. Nothing to be afraid of. But when you live in the forest, you realize how this is very, very, very pertinent, because actually the beasts in the forest are quite difficult to tell. And for example, I have one friend who lived in the forest in Sri Lanka, and he had some encounters with elephants while he was there. So since then, we'll like this story. He's perked up already. And, you know, he'd be walking through very, very remote forest and like this open air grass area, big, you know, huge, tall grassy area and so on. And he'd just be walking along and then an elephant would just step out right in front of him. He had no idea that it was there. And this huge animal, it's just right there. Yeah? And it would just step in front of him. And so there's a very primeval, very kind of terrifying experience, yeah, to encounter that kind of thing. It's fine for us to sort of, you know, sit and we can look at funny clips of elephants on YouTube or something like that and think, oh, aren't they cute, right? But when you're in the middle of the forest, there's nothing all around, and there's a huge elephant right there. It's one of the primeval fears that we have as human beings. So that step into the forest is a step into the world of the unconscious. It's a step into facing these deep-rooted fears and anxieties. It's a step into being with the cycles of birth, aging, and death. Okay, so that's one of the things that we try to hide from us with the structures of civilization. Yeah, so we hide the decay and the imperfection of things. You know, we make our dwelling as perfect as we can. We keep it clean. We keep any dirt out of it. When it starts to fall apart, we fix it up. We try to maintain this image of permanence, and we can lock things away and hide them. Yeah, so you notice how in our civilization we lock away aging and sickness and death, don't we? Yeah. Do you remember that story of the Bodhisattva when he, you know, when he was growing up in the palace, and his father would hide from him the any signs of aging, sickness, and death? Yeah. So we read this story. Yeah. The Buddha's father wouldn't let him see any old people or any sick people or any dead people. And we think, you know, it must be just a myth, right? No one would really do that. Yeah, it's impossible. Of course, except we do it all the time, right? Don't we? Yeah? We take the old people, we bung them in an old folks' home. We take the sick people, we bung them in a hospital. And we take the dead people, and we bung them in a morgue. Yeah? And we hide away from them. We don't see them, actually. Except very, very rarely. So that hiding of these realities of life is one of the things that civilization is built for. That's one of the orders, the structures that civilization is creating. And so those are being kind of wiped out when we go into the forest. And so we're being thrown back on our, not on our human culture, but on our instincts. Yeah. And on that, heading back to that world of the unconscious. And so in that world which is very formless, then that formlessness is a place of potential. It means it's a place where we're not being, our life is not being conditioned and determined by the expectations which culture is placing upon us. We're not being told, you know, this is your career. Yeah? So Siddhartha, when he was a young man, you know, he had a career mapped out for him. Yeah? And generally speaking, in those days in India, careers were much more fixed than they are for us today. You know, there was this is what you're expected to do with your life. Yeah? So when he takes that step out, he takes a step into formlessness. And anything can happen. And he didn't know what was going to happen. Yeah? And the word that he uses to describe this time of searching, he says, King Kusala Gawesi is on that search to find out an answer to the question, what is the good? To find an answer to the question, what is the good? King Kusala Gawesi. And so he did many different practices and so on to try to find the answer to that. And I won't go into too much detail with all the different stories and practices that the Buddha did, or the Bodhisattva did, before finding awakening. But that whole time he spent in great seclusion in the forest, and eventually attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. After that awakening experience, he then taught mostly in the forests and lived mostly in the forests. And would intersperse periods of wandering about from place to place, together with periods that were more settled, staying in a monastery. So of course, as time went on, and the Buddha's community grew, then monasteries started to develop, and the monastic life also began to grow its own structures. And this, I think, is a very important thing to notice, that in the beginning, that the Buddha's own search, yeah, didn't have any structures. Actually, he let go of any kind of structure and just relied on his own intuition and his own inner knowledge and sense of what was right and what was wrong. For the earliest generation of Sangha, monks and nuns, that there was also very little in the way of formal structure in how they ran their communities. They more or less also just wandered around from place to place. They would stay informally in the forest here and there. They would live in a cave for a while or stay under a tree. Maybe somebody would invite them to build a little leaf hut or something like that, and then they would move on after a period of time. But over the years, you know, things began to get more settled. Yeah, you can't live like that all the time. Sometimes the weather's just too bad. Yeah, sometimes it's raining for weeks on end in India. Sometimes people get sick. Yeah, people get old. Yeah, they have injuries. And so you can't just live not everybody can live the wandering mendicant lifestyle all the time. And so monasteries gradually began to form and to spring up. And as they began to form, they began to re-adopt some of those cultures and hierarchies and structures and expectations which the Buddha had actually left behind earlier. This is a major part in kind of the long story of the history of Buddhism. So many of those monasteries would have been what they call forest monasteries. and forest monasteries themselves would have taken a number of different forms. We don't really have, it's interesting that there's no archaeological sites from early Buddhism, so we don't really know what form those monasteries took in the earliest years, but no doubt they would have been structured in different ways in different times and places. And there was also would have been monks living in the towns as well. Monks and nuns living in the towns as well as in the forests. And that was, from time to time, a source of conflict and tension, because different people with different lifestyles, and that can come into conflict. And this has been also characteristic of Buddhism down to the present day. There's one very interesting passage when the Buddha was talking about two people meditating. Yeah? So, and it's a kind of a trick sutta, okay, a trick discourse. And the Buddha describes two meditators. One of them, he says, here's one monk who's sitting in a village, okay, in a little monastery or something in the village, and he's sitting meditating. His mind is very pure. The mind is very clear, and he's sitting in very, very good concentration. He has very good meditation, right? There's the other monk who's sitting in the middle of the forest, okay? He's sitting in the middle of the forest, and his meditation is absolutely nowhere, right? His meditation is rubbish. He's sitting there nodding away, falling asleep, can't get it together at all, yeah? So which one does the Buddha praise? The Buddha said, I praise the monk who's sitting in the forest. Yeah. Very, very interesting sutta. Because yeah? of course he's going to praise the one who's got good meditation. And if he's got such good meditation, even while he's sitting in the city, surely that makes it even better. Yeah? Where then the other monk, he's got all the advantages of sitting in the forest and the seclusion and the quiet and everything, and he still can't get his meditation together. But the Buddha said, no, he's the one I praise. And the reason for that is because, and explain its reason for that is because the one who's sitting meditation in the city, yeah, and because he's such a good monk and his meditation's so good, very soon lots of people are going to come to see him, and they're going to be coming and visiting him all the time, and they'll offer him lots of stuff, yeah, they'll give him lots of requisites because they think he's such a holy monk because he's such a good meditator, and they're going to give him lots of requisites, and so soon he'll be spending all of his time talking and distracted and get corrupted by wealth, and his meditation will fall apart. Whereas the one sitting in the forest, yes, his meditation's rubbish, but if he stays in the forest, keeps on practicing, eventually his meditation will get better. Yeah? So he has that context. So this is very, very characteristic of the Buddha's teachings. That he's not so much interested in where you are at, he's much more interested in where you are going. Yeah? We're all at different places in our practice, yeah. Wherever we're at, we just start where we're here. Where's the next step? What direction are we heading in? That's the important thing. So it doesn't matter too much whether you've got good meditation or bad meditation or anything like that. What matters is that we keep on practicing and keep on striving. So this gives you an indication of the praise that the Buddha gave to meditating in the forest and that lifestyle. But there's also another side to that, which also has to be acknowledged. There's another sutta the Buddha taught where he compared a bull elephant and a pussycat. Okay? And he said there was once a bull elephant that waded into the middle of a fast flowing stream of water and had a bath. Yeah? Took up water in its trunk and squirted it over its back and splashed around and had a great time bathing in this fast flowing stream of water. And on the bank of the stream was a little pussycat. And the little pussycat thought, wow, see that bull elephant having such a great time in that stream of water, I think I'll have a bath as well. And the cat jumps in the pool of water, stream of water, and of course gets washed away. And I don't know what happened to the poor cat in the end, whether it got drowned or what. Anyway, got pretty humiliated by the whole event. And so the Buddha used that as a simile for two meditators. One meditator was a Buddha, bull elephant, yeah, who was able to withstand the rigors and the difficulties, the loneliness, the seclusion of being in the forest, and went into the forest and benefited greatly. And then there's the other one who wasn't ready for it. Yeah, they weren't developed. There's like a little pussycat thinking that they can imitate the practice of the great meditators. So they went off into seclusion and basically everything just fell apart. Yeah? So that's like a counter narrative to the other one. Yeah. So it's always, there's always a story for every kind of situation, isn't there? Yeah? You can always counter these things. So in the Buddhist life, it's generally, monastic life, it's generally, we sort of settled on a kind of a model where when people first come along to ordain and they're interested to pursue the monastic life, that they spend a number of years, and it's typically about 5 years, training and practicing in a community under a particular teacher and learning the ropes. It's not too dissimilar from doing a degree, yeah, 5 years or so. So you have to learn that, and that's what you do in a community. And in that time, it's not really encouraged to be spending too long a period by yourself or in seclusion in the forest. Yeah, you can do it. It's not prohibited or anything. And especially if your meditation's good or something, then that's allowable. But generally, as a general rule of thumb, it's encouraged to spend that 5 years staying with a teacher and learning the Dhamma and so on before, if you want to head into seclusion and stay by yourself in the forest somewhere. So now, as Buddhism grew and developed in ancient India and then spread through different countries, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, up into Tibet, China, and so on, in each country that it arrived at, Buddhism would have to find, in order to survive, it has to find a way of relating and connecting with that local culture, right? You can't just sort of survive as a completely alien thing. You have to connect with things. We were talking just earlier about the relationship between Buddhism and psychotherapy. Yeah? Now, that's one of the ways that Buddhism is learning to adapt when it encounters Western culture. Yeah? Because Western culture is interested in psychotherapy. That's how we approach the mind. And, well, Buddhism's interested in the mind. And there's a kind of connection there. So part of how Buddhism adapts in a country like Australia is through that dialogue between various aspects of Buddhist practice and various aspects of psychology. Now, when Buddhism arrives in other cultures, say ancient Sri Lanka, or say Sri Lanka 2200 BC, or in Thailand in 500 AD or something like that, of course they didn't have psychotherapy in those days, right? You didn't have courses on Buddhism and psychotherapy. Right. What they did have was, of course, a variety of local indigenous religious traditions, animist traditions, perhaps in some places Brahmanical Hindu traditions, and so on. And so Buddhism learnt various ways of co-opting and adapting within that particular context. And so in China you find it's a kind of an interface between Buddhism and Taoism and Confucianism. In Tibet with the Bon religion, the local religion there, and so on in all of the different places. And so this is why when we see the existing Buddhist cultures from Tibet or China or Korea or wherever, that they all have great differences. Yeah, and we can see that they, you know, wear different robes, they do different ceremonies or different chanting, and it's all adapted to the local climate, language, culture, and so on. But there are some things which are very similar in all those places, yeah? And one of those things which is similar and which is common is the life of seclusion in the forest, yeah? Because all of those places have nature, yeah? They all have an environment. They all have forest in some way. Maybe in some places it's the mountains, maybe in some places it's the jungles or whatever. But there are always places of seclusion. And when you go to those countries, you always find that in some of the most bizarre and out of the way places. Whoops, there's a Buddhist monastery, right? You've seen the places in Tibet and so on where you go like right up the top of the mountain in these impossible places. You know, they've built these monasteries. I mean, it's just extraordinary, some of them. And everywhere you go, you'll find these things. And so this is part of the Buddhist culture which finds an expression in every Buddhist country. And so it's like the home culture of Buddhism, yeah? The native culture of Buddhism is a life of seclusion and meditation in the forest. And so we find a way of doing that wherever we are. It may be different, done differently in different places, but in essence, the idea is pretty much the same. So in, for example, ancient Sri Lanka, and in the various inscriptions and so on that we find from Sri Lankan history, that there are references to the Aranyaka, the forest tradition there. Similarly, in Thailand, in the Thai history, we find the reference to the Aranya tradition, the forest tradition. And so it's been a presence there down through the years. Now, the forest tradition my practice was the Thai forest tradition. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that Thai forest tradition and how it relates to that history I've been talking about. So just a little bit of historical background first. Thailand, as you may or may not know, was the only country in the Southeast Asian region not to be colonized. And so in the colonial era, while Burma was being colonized, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam and Malaysia, all the countries around Thailand were being colonized. Of course, Thailand itself was under a great threat, that it was going to be taken over. The way that they dealt with that threat was to centralize their country, strengthen the central administration, strengthen their own nationalist ideology, their sense of themselves as Thai, and they used Buddhism as an intrinsic part of that. So they developed a national ethos of themselves as a Buddhist people, preserving their own traditions. And in that process, they developed an idea of Buddhism as a rational religion which was suitable for modern times. Now remember, in those days, mid-19th century, you had a lot of Christian missionaries coming over to Asia, and basically they would come over and rubbish all of the native Asian traditions. You know, this is just superstition, it's just animism, it's just idol worship, you know, you're just doing mindless rituals, you people don't even know what you're reciting, you're worshipping ghosts, it's devil worship, you're going to go mad, all of these kinds of things, yeah? That's what they were saying, and sometimes they still say it, but anyway. In response to that, actually, a lot of that criticism was true, actually, right? A lot of it was mindless worship without knowing what they're doing. A lot of it was just animism. A lot of it was just idol worship. The criticisms weren't completely false, but, of course, there was also the very beautiful and very powerful parts of Buddhism as well. So different places around Asia, they went back and they said, well, what is the really valuable thing that we have in our Buddhist tradition? And in Thailand, they went back and they rediscovered, based on this Western impetus and this Western criticism, they rediscovered the what we call the Pali Canon, is the earliest scripture of Buddhism. And this was, I'm talking about the innovations developed by King Mongkut around the middle of the 19th century. And so they developed a form, a new, radically new and innovative form of Thai Buddhism, which said that the real practice of what we're doing here is based on these teachings found in the Pali Canon. Now this is a very new idea. Before that time, most people had never even seen the Pali Canon, never even read it. It didn't exist in most of the monasteries. And things were passed down by tradition, by hearsay, by the teachers, you know, local teachers and so on. And so Mongkut came along and said, no, let's get back to the source. Let's see what the Buddha really taught. And let's sift out what the Buddha really taught from what has accrued over the generations and through time. And so this was the project which he began in the mid 19th century. Now, Mongkut was he was a crown prince, and he was an administrative and scholar monk living in Bangkok. So he didn't emphasize meditation very much. But the thing is that if you do that, right, if you start reading the early Buddhist scriptures, right, you can't help but read about meditation. Almost every sutta, every second sutta at least, is talking about meditation. It's all constantly saying, go off to the forest, live in seclusion, yeah, practice meditation, practice meditation. Jayata bhikkhave ma pamadatta, ma vo paccha vipatisarata. Jayata means practice jhanas, like do jhana meditation. Don't be negligent, don't regret it later. So these words constantly found through this Pali Canon. So it didn't take long for some of the monks in Thailand to start to want to put this into practice and start to think, well, look, let's really see what these things are talking about. And the most famous of those monks was a monk called Ajahn Mun. And he practiced in the early part of the first half of the 20th century. Now, Ajahn Mun was born in a town called Ubon Ratchathani, which is one of the major centres in the northeast of Thailand, which is the poorest region of Thailand, even today. And in those days, it was very poor and very remote region, and not even completely assimilated with the central Thai culture. They speak a different language and largely different food and so on. So Ajahn Mun decided to go and test these teachings and to see whether they really worked. Okay, they have this thing in there called arahant. Ever heard of an arahant? Yeah? Arahant, fully enlightened one. Yeah? You're kind of curious, yeah? When you hear about this idea, I remember when I first started reading about Buddhism, I read this word arahant and I thought, wow, what, you know, an actual enlightened, fully enlightened person or being or whatever you call them. Is that real? Does that actually exist? Are there people like that actually living in this world today? I remember that's what I was thinking. And this is, again, what Ajahn Mun thought. And Ajahn Mun was obviously a very extraordinary person, a very strong individual. And so he wasn't just content to wonder about it or speculate about it. He really wanted to test it. So he wanted to go out and practice and try to realize it for himself. And so this is what he did. Ajahn Mun lived a very famously austere life. He was a rag robe wearer, which means that his robes weren't nice cotton robes like these ones I have here, but they were sort of pieced together, hand-stitched from whatever rags that he could find around the place. And sometimes, you know, they would find bits of just old rag lying here and there and stitch them together to make a robe. They would live off alms food. And in those days in northeast Thailand, the alms food would have been sticky rice was the main staple, and a bit of, you know, a banana or a bit of fish sauce or something like that. Sometimes like forest vegetables and things like that. So a very Spartan diet. And they would wander from place to place and stay in little leaf huts and so on, with a small community of dedicated meditators. And when I was in Thailand, I met one of the last disciples, Ajahn Mun, that died in the 1950s. But I met one of the last monks who had practiced with him in northern Thailand. And he said that the way of practice that they did was that they would each live on separate hilltops. Okay? It was a mountainous region in northern Thailand. And so they each had like a whole mountain. That's how secluded they were. And every week, yeah, their only contact was that every week they'd go to the highest point of the mountain and hold up a lantern to and they could see the other lanterns to make sure that they were still alive. Yeah? So, and then they'd get back and get on to their practice. Yeah. Ajahn Mun very famously, they were not, it was not a movement which was interested in study very much. And remembering that in that time, that the reform movement of Buddhism under King Mongkut had been almost entirely a study-based movement. They actually didn't meditate. Yeah? A lot of the monks didn't meditate at all. It was normal. Yeah? And so it's a kind of a reaction against that. Of course, actually, most of those monks in those days had already done their studies. They'd already done, you know, 3 years in Bangkok studying at a monastic college or something like that. So they actually had that background already. But they weren't interested to pursue that as like a career, to become a scholar or a writer or something like that. So, but they wanted to practice. Actually, one of Ajahn Mun's close friends was another monk called Upali, who you don't really hear about very much these days, but Upali was probably more famous in his lifetime, and he was actually one of the most famous scholar monks in Bangkok. And they were friends, childhood friends from the same village. And they used to consult with each other and so on. Ajahn Mun would share his experiences, and Upali would explain how that related to things that happened in the suttas and in the scriptures and so on. So Ajahn Mun kept on coming back to that question of actually how do we practice? How do we actually apply the Dhamma? And so he had these external aspects of practice, so, you know, the seclusion, the strict practice of the monastic discipline, the use of austerities, eating one meal a day and so on. So all of those external aspects. But then, of course, even more important than those is the inner aspects in terms of especially the meditation development. So now, at that time in Thailand, a lot of the meditation actually wasn't very Buddhist, right? So a lot of the meditation was actually quite closely related to like black magic and things like that. So it was like trying to meditate in order to get special powers, yeah? Or to be able to like see next week's lottery number, for example, right? And these things are so common still in Thailand. You wouldn't believe it, I mean, honestly. And when I was at I'll just give you one example of that. When I was in northern Thailand, I was staying at a particular hut in the forest. And one day, had a few workers came and they made a walking meditation path for me. So you may have seen at some of the huts around here, we have a walking meditation path. So they made one of these for me. And one of the things that we do is to test how long the path is by pacing it out, see how many paces it is. And so I paced out the path and it was like 39 paces or something like that. And one of the workers saw me doing this and he said, "Oh, how many paces is that?" And I said, "Oh, 39. He said, "Oh, okay." So I didn't think anything of it. Right? A few weeks later, that worker saw the owner of the hut, right? So there was a particular fellow who owned it, and he saw the owner of the hut, and he said, "Wow," he said to him, that Western monk you've got at that hut, he gives great lottery numbers. He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Oh, look," he said, he told me the number 39, and you know, I went back that night and I told all my family and friends. I said, "Listen, I've got this great lottery number from my monk, and you know, we've got to all go out and make sure we get all number 39 in the lottery." And all my family, none of them believed me. You know, they said, "Oh, it's a load of rubbish. You know, he didn't mean anything by it." So I said, "Okay, I'll go out and buy it." So he bought it, and then he won. Yeah. So. And then the very next day, I was walking for alms in the village, right? So every day I'd go for alms and just sort of collecting what's offered in the bowl in the village. And there was one fellow who was giving alms, and I'd been to this place for 6 months or something. And every day he'd been coming out and giving alms, and he'd never said anything, right? He'd just come out and put a little something in my bowl, and that was it. And this day, for the first day, he said to me, "Oh, by the way, Bhante, how old are you?" So I told him, and then I thought for a minute. I said, "Hang on, why are you asking that?" It doesn't take long for the reputation to get around. There was another time when Ajahn Chah, he was a great forest monk, and he spent the last number of years of his life in a coma. And there was this this masseur used to come up from Bangkok, this very expert masseur used to come up and massage him when he was in his coma. And one of the monks said to him, you know, that's a really great service you're doing, coming all this way to treat Ajahn Chah. You know, it's a tremendous merit that you're making. He said, well, no, not really. He said, sorry? He said, no, I'm not actually making any merit by doing this. He said, what do you mean? He said, oh, I just come for the lottery numbers. And the monk said, how? What do you mean? Ajahn Chah's in a coma. He can't give you any lottery numbers. He said, no, when I'm massaging him, you know, I'll see him twitch like 3 times. So write down 3. So we kind of laugh at, you know, but this is, it's very real. And if you've lived in Thailand or something, you know that this is actually, it's true. This is how people think. And so that was a lot of the kind of meditation, was this kind of thing, like fortune-telling, prophecies, and all of these kinds of things, and not so much like the real Buddhist meditation. And so when they rediscovered the real Buddhist meditation in the Pali Canon, then there was this kind of experiment to try to practice it and see what would work and how to do it. And so the forest monks in that time had a very much an experimental attitude to practice, try things out and see what works. And the Thai forest tradition is not based very much on a systematic practice, right? You don't find them sort of having sort of very organized systems of meditation, first do this and then do that and so on and so forth. But it's much more intuitive, yeah, to use your intuitive wisdom and sense of awareness and to trust in mindfulness. So that if you go, if you're in Thailand, you go to a forest monastery and you ask, I'm meditating, and then you say, what meditation do you do? And you say, well, I do breath meditation, or I do loving kindness, or I do this, and, you know, is that okay? You know, and you'll ask them, you know, what should I practice? And then usually what they'll say is, you know, that's fine, keep on practicing, but just stay with your mindfulness. So they're not concerned to sort of tell you you have to practice like this or like that, which can be a bit frustrating sometimes, you know, because I want you to tell me, tell me what to do. But they won't, yeah, by and large. But what they want to do is they want to get you to look within and to connect with that sense of mindfulness and awareness, which is actually where the real wisdom comes from. In terms of the actual meditations that they developed, Ajahn Mun, mainly they practiced breath meditation. So the watching the mind, the breath coming in and out, making the mind peaceful with that. They practiced Buddho, which is the recollection of the Buddha using a mantra, Buddho. Sometimes that's used together with the breath. Okay, so breathing in Buddha and breathing out To, breathing in Buddha, breathing out To. But sometimes used independently. And they did a lot of body investigation. And so these kind of body contemplation meditations, which are taught in the Satipatthana Sutta and elsewhere. So for example, like investigating your skeleton, sort of sitting down there and imagining what your skeleton appears like and looking at it in different aspects and so on. And so these meditations were done in many, many different ways by the forest tradition masters, and you can read about their different approaches to meditation in their books. One of the things that I'd like to sort of emphasize here is that, you know, when you read the teachings in the books, one thing to remember is that what somebody teaches is very often the exact opposite of what's actually happening. Right? That's why they teach it. Right? If somebody's already practicing something, you don't teach that something. You just say, fine. Yeah? You teach them what they don't know. You teach them what they need to do that they're not actually doing. Right? Yeah? So when you read the stories of the forest monks, you know, often they'll sound like they're very stern and very severe, yeah? Especially Ajahn Mun or Ajahn Mahabua, they're very kind of aggressive, you know? They sort of, you know, jump into that boxing ring and kick your defilements down and bash them up and, you know, all of these kinds of language that they use. Ajahn Mahabua was one of the other great forest monks, and he was a kickboxer before he was a monk, so he sort of keeps that kind of attitude going. I was saying to someone the other day, actually Ajahn Mahabua is still alive, he's in his late 90s by now, but his actual sponsor is Red Bull. Yeah? So which is this whole synergy. It's fantastic. Yeah, so wherever he goes around Thailand, it's just vans, Red Bull vans, got crates of Red Bull everywhere. Yeah. So, but what and what the and that, so it's always kind of a lot about striving and diligence and, you know, all of these kinds of things. Well, what does that tell you? It tells you that the people that he's talking to were actually very relaxed, yeah, actually really taking it easy. You know, they used to just kind of hang out and, you know, and just have a pretty, you know, relaxed, happy time. Yeah? That's why those teachings are given. Yeah? And that's pretty much my own experience in the forest monasteries, is that actually living in the forest monasteries and being there, you know, with the Thai monks in there, that they're actually usually pretty easygoing places, yeah? Monks are, you know, really relaxed and quiet, and, you know, you just go there and get on with doing your thing without too much fuss. And it's actually a very warm and very, very friendly and accepting kind of vibe that you get in these places. And so this is why often those teachers are very much emphasizing, you know, get up and go, keep doing your practice and so on, these aspects. And of course, when we're in our environment, in our culture, then often it's a different need, isn't it? Yeah, we're often so much conditioned to be goal-orientated. We're conditioned to work really hard. We're conditioned to always be trying to get something. So for us, it's much more important to hear teachings on letting go, just relaxing, taking it easy. Yeah? That's what we need to develop, is that ability to not do anything, right? Yeah. So this is just a few of the aspects of the forest tradition of taught by Ajahn Mun. When Ajahn Mun, as he taught, he gathered around him a group of disciples, and many of whom went on to become great teachers themselves. One of the monks who was his student, only for a short period of time, was another monk called Ajahn Chah. And so I'm just sort of rounding out the story here, but Ajahn Chah was also from a similar area in northeast Thailand to Ajahn Mun, and he also started out as a study monk in the local village monastery. Later on, he went into the forest, studied and practiced with many different teachers, spent a brief time with Ajahn Mun, and eventually started his own monastery called Wat Bapong near Ubon Ratchathani in northeast Thailand. And so Ajahn Chah is always regarded as one of the great masters of the Thai forest tradition. And I never met him personally. He passed away before I got there. But by all accounts, a tremendously charismatic teacher, somebody who had the seemingly almost limitless ability to draw people to him with the sheer power of his metta and his charisma, that people would just be drawn to him and he would just magnetize and uplift people effortlessly. And somebody who had extraordinary energy and devotion and dedication to what he was doing. Many, many stories about Ajahn Chah, but one story that sticks in my mind from that I was told by one of the monks was that that his monastery, they used to have a practice of the all-night meditation sittings. Okay, so once a week, they'd all come, both the monks, but also the villagers, yeah, would come and they'd all sit together in the hall all night and meditate, or at least try to meditate. Yeah. We did that at the monastery I ordained at Wat Nanachat. We also used to do that once a week. And so it was quite funny because often you'd see the monks up there sitting trying to meditate and... And maybe these old women from the village would be just like this. And they'd sit down at like 10 o'clock at night, you know, and 4 o'clock in the morning, then the bell would go, they'd sort of get up and do their chanting. So, anyway, so this one night Ajahn Chah was doing this, and he'd led the chanting, and the monks had recited their Parimokkha, their rules of discipline, and then he'd given a Dhamma talk, started his Dhamma talk at about 10 o'clock and finished it around midnight. And then he got up and sat meditation for an hour or two. And then after he finished meditation, he got up from his seat and was going to go, left the hall. And this other monk who I knew saw he was doing that and went to accompany him. He took his bag and walked with him back to his hut. And Ajahn Chah said to this monk, he said, "Oh, look, you know," he said, "I don't think I'll sit up meditation all night tonight. I've had malaria for the last 3 days." So this monk was completely astounded, you know. And he's suffering from one of the worst fevers you can possibly have. And just completely shrugged it off. Yeah? He was an old man. Yeah? Absolutely shrugged it off. But, you know, he thought he might just not sit meditation all night as an excuse for having malaria. So that was the kind of person that Ajahn Chah was. Yeah? His energy and dedication was quite phenomenal. But he also had a very playful way about him. He was so strong that you could be very terrified of him. And the monks say that when he was giving a talk, when he would start, he'd use the word, in Thai you have the word krap, which is like a polite particle, okay? And normally krap is used when you're talking to someone who's senior to you. So if the monk was talking to Ajahn Chah, they say krap is a sign of seniority, but when he was talking to someone junior, then of course he wouldn't normally use it. But when he started using that particle in his Dhamma talk, then you knew that there was something really bad going to come up. So as soon as you say, "Okay, Venerable Sirs, krap," and they'd be going, "Oh no, what's happened now?" And so he used to have all of these very playful ways of teaching his disciples. I've just tell a couple of stories here. One time, because the monks used to go for alms once a day. Come back, and all you get is what you get in your alms bowl that day. That's it, right? So it gets pretty tense around the mealtime, okay? You're pretty hungry, right? And, you know, that's it. It's a lump of sticky rice and a few bits and pieces of other things, and it's like everything vectors in around that time of the meal, yeah? So it becomes a pretty important moment. And at that time, this was in the early 70s, the US Army had built a base near Uban Ratchathani, and they were flying their B-52s in the Vietnam War, as a result of which many, many bad things happened, but some good things happened, including the first ice cream parlour in the local town. Okay? And so there came the inevitable day, sort of marks the beginning of the end for the real forest tradition, is the day when ice cream was brought along for the monks for the first time. Yeah. And so, of course, all the monks, you know, you're used to eating rotten fish sauce and sticky rice and forest vegetables, yeah? So when ice cream appears, right, you know, a lot of these monks probably wouldn't have had ice cream before, right? The Western monks had, but a lot of the Thai monks and things, it's just a word they've heard, yeah? So ice cream appears, all the monks sitting there. Trying to be peaceful. But, of course, you have to put everything in your bowl, right? So everything goes into the same bowl. Okay, and so they hand the ice cream down, and everyone puts a lump of ice cream into their bowl, and they hand it down, and then you cover up the bowl, you give the blessing, and then you eat your meal. Right? But this day, for some strange reason, after they'd given the blessing, before they started to eat, Ajahn Chah found all of this business that he had to do with one of the lay people from the village. "Oh, by the way, did you check what happened to that hut out the back? I mean, we had a leaky roof there. Did you manage to see what was happening?" "Oh, yes." And then this and then that. And he kept on talking and talking and talking. Of course, all the monks had to sit because they couldn't start eating before Ajahn Chah started eating. So they're all sitting and the tension's growing. It's going more powerful in the room. And eventually Ajahn Chah was like, "Oh, okay, well, let's start eating." So they all opened the lid of their bowl and the ice cream had completely disappeared. Yeah, it had melted and been absorbed into the sticky rice and rotten fish sauce. Yeah. It's gone. Yeah. Oh, the pain of that moment. Yeah. Yeah. So this is the kind of things that he used to do. One time somebody came up to Ajahn Chah and said to him, "Do you teach your disciples, do you teach your students by reading their minds?" Yeah, so this is what a lot of people want, isn't it? Yeah, we want somebody to come along, read our mind, yeah, and then tell us what we have to do. Oh, yes, yes, this is the right meditation for you. You know, this is what you have to do. And this is how a lot of people think. So they asked this question to Ajahn Chah. He said, no. Here, I teach my students to read their own minds. Yeah? So that absolutely captures Ajahn Chah's philosophy, the way he's doing it. He's there to teach everybody to read their own minds. And so he'd constantly use these methods for teaching his students. And just tell one other story. This one time when the monks again had got back from the alms round and they were getting ready to eat their meal. Now what happened at that time? The practice was that when you got some sticky rice and usually some bits of other things, and all the other bits and pieces were put into a central bowl and then shared out among all the monks. Okay, and then but you kept the sticky rice that you wanted to eat for that meal. You kept it in your bowl. But you're supposed to put all the other things into the central thing. And this time they sort of did that. They shared the meal out and everything, and they're getting ready to eat. But instead of getting ready to eat, Ajahn Chah gets off his seat and then walked very, very slowly down the line of monks. Okay? And all the monks are sitting there thinking, oh, don't stop in front of me, don't stop in front of me, don't stop in front of me. Ajahn Chah very slowly goes down until he comes to the novice at the end of the line. You know, he's only a young boy, he's like, you know, 12 or something like that. And so he looks in the novice's bowl, he pulls out the lump of sticky rice and opens it up, you know, because it's really sticky, it's in a lump. And there was an egg inside the lump of sticky rice. So this poor little novice, you know, couldn't stand the idea of losing his egg and giving it up. So he'd hidden it in the rice. So he could keep his egg. So Ajahn Chah picked up the lump of rice, opened it up, and said, oh, look, this sticky rice has laid an egg. So anyway, it just gives you some idea of the teaching methods Ajahn Chah used. So the forest tradition is not about, you know, a kind of a particular doctrine or system or something like that, but it's about finding skillful ways to deal with the causes of suffering. That's what Ajahn Chah would always say. It's come back to those essential teachings, the Four Noble Truths and so on, which were at the heart of the Buddha's teaching. Anyway, I've been talking for a little bit too long already this evening, so I'd like to stop there. But are there any comments or questions about that or anything else?
Okay. I really like the story about the pussycat meal.
Yeah, go for a swim. Well, that's true. I mean, you try it, but you try it in a smaller creek first, rather than plunging into the swift flowing stream. Yeah. So that's why you can try out little bits of seclusion and solitude, see how they go, and then if it's good and it works well, then try a bit longer and so on.
Question is, when Buddhists encourage from culture to culture to adapt to suit the culture, do you find that there's a danger there that some of the key tenets of Buddhism might be lost, or is that a possibility?
Well, of course, it's always a possibility. What I find is curious is that every country that you go to, you find debased forms of Buddhism. Right? Now, that's just passing purely a value judgment. Right? I could be very postmodern and relativist and say, well, everyone's path is valid and so on and so forth. So if I was being politically correct, I could probably say that. But the reality is that in a lot of these places, Buddhism isn't much more than just, you know, doing some bowing, Buddha, 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 give me a Mercedes, and these kinds of things, right? Now, if someone wants to do that, it's not harmful, right, particularly. Right? So Buddhism tends to not take on very harmful forms, you know. At the very least, it's done things like abolishing human sacrifice and animal sacrifice. Yeah, these are things you find in animist religions all over the world. And one of the major parts of the narrative of the history of Buddhism was the abolition of animal sacrifice and human sacrifice. And it's done that pretty well. You rarely find those things in Buddhist cultures. So there are some things which is done extremely successfully, other things not so much. But also I think what you find is that within each culture that there are people who have the wisdom to be able to cut through all of that stuff and to actually come back to the essence of the teaching. And that's something I've been quite struck by, and it's one of the things I've really learnt from some of the conferences that I've gone to, like the Mitra conference and other places where you hear so many great teachers from different traditions, and you find that the really good ones just cut through all the stuff. Yeah? And so of course, yeah, they still have a bit of a different perspective on things, but you know, it's like, I mean, great example being the Dalai Lama. Now, if you look at Tibetan Buddhism, so much stuff, you know, my goodness, you know, everything, all the things you can imagine, the symbolisms and all these kinds of things. And it's such a complex system and all the philosophies and so on and everything. It's a very, very rich tradition. But you know, Dalai Lama said in one of his books that I read, he said, you know, when you come back to it, you know, if you ask what are really the things that I think are valuable is the Four Noble Truths and acting with compassion for the sake of helping beings. These are the things that I keep coming back to as being the heart of my religion. So... and I think the same, you know, that's a similar process to what we saw in the forest tradition in Thailand. It's like a leaving aside a lot of the externalities and sort of coming back to the heart of things.
Yeah? Mansa, the other day you were saying that, you know, there tends to be, there's a tendency of self-loving within the Western society, and it can be a bit hard for them to develop, like, loving kindness to themselves. And it feels really dry, for example. What would be your advice at the beginning stage, for example, to really develop that?
To do loving kindness for yourself. Yeah.
To really acknowledge that you're worthy of love.
Yeah. Well, just...
Without just reading it in your mind, and but then really to cultivate that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. First of all, just trying. And... Well, I'm kind of hesitating because I don't know the answer, and it's something that I think is also probably very personal, quite individual. In some cases, it may be useful to sort of engage with the story of why that's so, okay, by doing some therapy or something like that. That may be useful in certain circumstances. In other cases, simply to... if you're finding it very difficult to develop loving kindness for yourself, then just start where it's easy. Yeah, so always take the path of least resistance. Yeah, whatever's easy. If you can develop loving kindness for your pussycat or for your dad or for whatever, then do that. Yeah, and when that you get the feeling of loving kindness developed, then we can come back to doing it for ourselves.
But just following up on that question, when you are doing loving kindness meditation and you do find, say, some darker feelings coming up at the end of that, is that problematic at all, or is that just
at the end, you mean?
Yeah, darker feelings do come up, as in like maybe you feel a sense of coldness towards the end of it, or it brings up some emotion or anger or whatever.
When you say at the end, you mean like
just during it?
During the practice itself?
Yeah. Is that quite normal, or is that?
Or are you going mad? Is that the question?
No.
It is actually no. It is because in a way those things come up. I think partly by way of contrast, and it sometimes it can even intensify, because intensifying it, meditation intensifies everything. Yeah? Your mind becomes more clear, and any emotion or thought or anything that you have becomes more clear. So the dark emotions can also become more clear. And when you develop the positive ones, then it's kind of natural. The mind sort of has a habit to sort of oscillate back, and those darker ones can come up as well. So if that happens from time to time, then I wouldn't worry about it. If you start to notice it happening really consistently, then it maybe need to think about doing something about that.
Yeah, just sometimes you can build some fear around it if that happens. So
right.
You want to just... leave out that and do the mindfulness, you could say, for almost sometimes.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
When you talked about going to the forest, like monks going to the forest and meditating, and some of them go for years, obviously. But how is the struggle between doing that because they have a goal of, okay, I'm going to get enlightened, but then in parallel, shouldn't they serve humanity and maybe develop their compassion? Because you mentioned also that they get quite severe in the forest, you know, different style of living and all that. So what's the goal really? Is it, I want to get enlightened, so it's all about me, or I want to serve others, or it happens after they get enlightened?
Ah, you know, a bit of both. Whatever. It's different for everyone. Yeah?
But when they spend all their life there, and let's say at the end, doesn't happen.
So yeah, you'd be really pissed off, wouldn't you?
They didn't serve anyone, they didn't even do anything for themselves.
I know, terrible, huh?
They should change the style altogether.
Yeah. Well, it's different things for different people. People develop different qualities, yeah? Different times in their spiritual practice. Different things are important for you, you know. Different people have different personalities. You know, some people that you try to stick them in the middle of the forest, they just go balmy, you know. Other people you try to put them in a role of helping in a community and they go balmy, you know. So it's different characters flourish in different situations. Sometimes we have different things that we need to develop in different circumstances. The reality is that there's actually only a tiny percentage of monks and nuns who actually live like that for the whole of their life. I mean, there's a fair amount of people who do it for periods of time, you know, maybe a few weeks or a few months or a few years. But the amount of people who do it, you know, really live completely in seclusion like that for their whole lives is tiny. Yeah? The reality is that almost everybody, you know, you find a balance, and so we need to find that balance. And I think certainly for most people, spending periods of time in seclusion and meditation is a fantastic thing.
Yeah. So if they spend time in some very isolated place, they can't obtain alms.
Yep.
How do they get food?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, generally speaking, in the forest monasteries, there has to be a balance of seclusion and accessibility, right? So Sati Monastery is actually perfect in that regard. Yeah, this is the perfect forest monastery, okay? So we're far enough from the village to be quiet, you know, at the end of a cul-de-sac, so you don't get through traffic or anything. But we can still walk into the village for alms, yeah? And so that's actually the perfect distance. Somewhere like, say, what Buddhadhamma you may be familiar with in the north of Sydney, Wiseman's Ferry, is a bit too remote. Yeah, so it's much more difficult for them. They can't walk for alms. It's more difficult for people to support them. So that's getting quite problematic. It's always been a struggle there because of that. So you sort of try to maintain that. In Thailand, when you'd have these monks wandering through the forest, almost always there's a village nearby that you can go for alms around to and get something to eat, even if just a little bit. And, you know, usually you wouldn't stay unless there was that. Occasionally, yes, you get in situations where there isn't anybody. And then they might just, you know, eat something, wild bananas or something like that until they can get back to civilization. But for the most part, there's someone around. Yeah.
Talking about the seclusion, actually, Beatrice was saying that she heard motorbikes last night.
During the day.
I don't know if this is like somewhere in the place which is supposed to be remote.
How do you know that you're getting somewhere? Like, really know?
You wouldn't.
Yeah, but what if you felt like you were, but that you weren't? Quite sure. No one ever talked about it.
Well, but the standard the Buddha always used is our wholesome qualities increasing and unwholesome ones decreasing.
How can you measure?
Well, one way is you get a pile of black stones and a pile of white stones. And every time you have an unwholesome thought, you put a black stone in the pile, and every time you have a wholesome thought, you put a white stone there.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
You asked. No, but seriously, it's just you do it by reflecting, yeah? You're reflecting on your own qualities. Do I tend to have more greed, hatred, and delusion in me or less? Yeah? And so you just sort of gain a sense for that.
I was just about to ask a similar question. Mm. Do you think that you can realistically measure the degree to which someone is enlightened for the purposes of, say, just empirically determining the effectiveness of...
Empirically determining the effectiveness of being a Buddhist? No.
Because, for
a whole variety of reasons, but partly because our understanding of the mind is not good enough. Our ability
That's
to
what we're trying to increase our understanding of the mind.
Sure, yeah, but the problem is that the Buddha said that, you know, somebody's not able to judge or assess a person who's at a higher level of spiritual development than they are. So if you've got, unless you've got the arahants running the experiment, then it's going to be very difficult, because they don't. How do you know what enlightenment means? Okay, you can have certain kinds of ways of testing these things in psychology. For example, you can do MRIs, brain scans, and things like that. But they will only get like a snapshot of the brain, and we don't really know what that means. Yeah? So you can say, yeah, somebody has those centers that tend to light up when somebody has compassion or something like that. But you can't really test anything from that. And the other thing is, enlightenment is not a state of mind. And so because it's not a state of mind, then there's no reason to think it's a state of the brain. So there are other kinds of things that you might test. So, for example, you might test behaviours or something like that, but that's only an indirect assessment of someone's enlightenment. Then you might come back to somebody's self-reporting about their states. But again, people will, when you come to these very subtle spiritual levels, you say to someone says, I felt peaceful. What does to feel peaceful mean? Yeah? It means very different things to different people. So personally, I don't think the measures to actually objectively assess these things exist.
But let's say we just defined it in some way, like come up with some definition of enlightenment, such as an enlightened person is kind, humble, patient.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had this list of, you know, so-called virtues that we say that's what makes an enlightened person.
Mm-hmm.
And we can easily measure all those things. Like, you can develop all sorts of self-report or, you know, peer report sort of scales. And let's say you had a really tidy way of doing that. Should we do that? Like, and say, like, test people that have become ordained or people who spend to realistically determine if it makes a difference.
Well, yeah, what I think you should, yeah. What I think that I think it's useful to do those kinds of tests if you perform a certain role, but what I think you need to do is to leave enlightenment out of it. Because as soon as you bring enlightenment into it, you're making some kind of a priori assumption that you know what it is, and that you know, you've just given a list of qualities there, but somebody else will give a different list of qualities or see it in a very different way. So I think it would be much more useful to come from a question of, well, what can we test, that we think are going to be good qualities to develop? And then, of course, you can write that list of qualities, and then try to test those things, But then assumptions as to whether that constitutes enlightenment or not. I mean, the Buddha described enlightenment as, like, you know, the ending of greed, hatred, and delusion, such that it's never going to arise again in the future. That's not something you can test for in that way. You can see whether it's present now, maybe, but you can't test whether it's ever going to arise again in the future. So until, I think, our means of measuring become much more subtle, and perhaps they can't, I don't know. I don't think you're ever going to be able to test that objectively. I mean, I think, you know, there are the tests of meditators having MRI scans and things. I think those things are very interesting, yeah? And they certainly perform a great role, especially in... the main role that they perform is that they create a dialogue and a way of presenting meditation which allows the benefits of meditation to be brought into secular spheres in a way that it can't when it's presented, say, from myself, from a Buddhist background. So you can present the evidence from the MRI scans and stuff, you can go along to a hospital and say, here's the benefits, you know, your cancer patients should be doing meditation because here it's now been statistically proven that you recover better from chemotherapy if you do meditation, or whatever the case may be. So I think that those things are useful for that reason. But I don't think they're going to get you enlightened. Yeah,
I'm just going back to Cynthia's question. Is there a reason why self-loathing is so present in, like, Western culture? I mean, why self-loathing? Because we're not really sort of taught to listen to ourselves.
I don't want to be critical of other religions, but Christianity's got a lot to do with it. And if you look at the history of... No, I mean, quite seriously, if you look at the history of Christianity, especially up to the 20th century, a lot of it is filled with self-loathing. And that's something which was the great criticism of Christianity by Friedrich Nietzsche, the great German philosopher. And I think his criticism was correct. I also think that the Christians, while they have tended to reject Nietzsche, have actually surreptitiously accepted that a lot of his criticisms were correct, and that they've actually changed the way that they do a lot of things because of those criticisms. So I don't think that those attitudes of self-loathing and so on are certainly current and explicit in most Christianity, mainstream Christianity as it's practiced today. So, for example, I didn't experience it when I was at going to Catholic school, right? And it's very, very different, you know. When I was at Catholic school, I was brought up, it was very post-Vatican II, it was very liberal, religion classes were just kind of discussions about what you thought was right or whatever like that. There was no doctrine or anything like that. At the same time, I read James Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, which, if you've ever read it, contains these incredibly graphic descriptions of the lectures on hell which they used to receive when they went to their Catholic school. Okay, and these were from James Joyce's own experience in a Catholic school in Ireland in the early 20th century. And they just sit there and tell these young boys over and over, they'd go every day, this was the lesson, describing in graphic detail all the pains of hell and all the different levels of hell and all the torments that they'd be suffering. And this was hammered into their head day after day after day after day. So that's really changed. And I think that Christianity has shifted. But I think that there is that undercurrent, that psychological undercurrent is still there, and I think that's really where the roots of this come from. Yeah.
Can I go back to the point that you were elaborating on? If there's no real way of measuring and what you've said and what is said about what enlightenment is, is it really specifically outlined, or is it a little bit general? And because my understanding of it is always there's what's said, you know, that you don't have any of the bad stuff arising, but is it more than that that can't be described? Because it's so sort of you know, out there in a way as a concept. That I imagine it to be something that you can't actually describe properly, that there's no way of actually really describing it because it's an embodied state.
Sure.
And so it's got something to do with, you know, your field of perception and just a really deep sort of understanding of everything in a way.
Yeah, I mean.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, I think the
problem. Like, you know, what does that mean?
Yeah, but the problem is that no description fully captures anything. Yeah.
Like, yeah. There are degrees. You know.
No, I don't even know if there are degrees really. You know, there was this great story in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and he talks about when he's a literature teacher. And he gave his class an essay to write an essay on the town hall in the local town. Do you remember that story? No, you don't remember. And the student comes back to him and says, I can't think of anything to write about the town hall. It's a really boring building and so on. So he says, okay, write a story about the front wall of the town hall. He says, hang on, but I can't write about the whole town hall. How do you expect me to write about the front wall of it? So we're going to do it. I can't do that. He says, okay, well, write me a you know, 5,000-word essay on one brick in the front wall of the town hall. And so he goes away and writes a fantastic 5,000-word essay on one brick. So actually, and no doubt that you know, you could have taken that essay and then written an analysis and commentary on that, and somebody could have written a rebuttal of it, and somebody should have done further reflections. And actually, you can never fully capture anything with words. And if even a brick, yeah, is so elusive, then when we're talking about very abstract and profound things, then it's going to be even more so. So the point is not really whether something can be completely captured in words. The point is whether the words that are used are sufficient for practical purposes. And so that's the question. Yeah? Is enlightenment described sufficiently clearly that it can actually be a guide for us in our spiritual practice? And so that's what the Buddha claimed it was.
And what do you think? Because you're an expert in text analysis.
Oh, I think it's, yeah, pretty much okay.
So far, it's
yeah.
Helping you, you know, understand state beings and helping other people.
Sorry, Maya, we've got another question.
Sorry.
I was just going to say, isn't the only real way to measure it is
like yourself, by asking yourself? Like,
of course.
It's not sort of a personal measure. And I guess if you feel more close to the truth, then, you know, I guess that's a good sign, but... Yeah, I guess it's like, it's difficult to really describe it or put it in words, but it's just that feeling.
Yeah. And you have to keep on inquiring. This is the main thing. Yeah.
I guess that's why it's hard to measure, because it's just, you know, you can't really describe your feeling.
Yeah.
And I suppose health is very important for meditation practice. But for forest monks like Ajahn Mun, who have a very austere lifestyle, is that a kind of self-torture? And sacrifice the health or even lives for spiritual practice?
Yeah, well, it's quite a good question. I think there is that tendency, there is that ascetic strain in Buddhism that can sometimes sort of go over to that extreme of you know, being a bit sort of torturing yourself and stuff like that. Whether that was the case for the forest monks in Thailand and Ajahn Mun and so on, how would I know? I wasn't there. Remembering, of course, that they were brought up in a pretty austere way. I mean, you see photographs of Ajahn Mun and he looks like really skinny and stuff. Then you see photos of everyone from northeast Thailand from that era. They're all pretty skinny, right? So it's not, he wasn't that different from other people. So I think that there is that tendency. And yes, there is kind of a tendency sometimes to kind of disparage the body and so on, which, you know, again, you don't find in the early scriptures. I mean, the Buddhist monastic code is very clear on that one should make reasonable provision for medicine and various kinds of things for health. And the Buddha would always... immediately comply if people asked, you know, said, I need this for medicine or I need this allowance or something, and the Buddha would say, yeah, fine. So, it is a tendency you need to watch out for. And sometimes we equate spiritual progress with pain. And I think that needs to be looked out for.
Can I ask another continuation of my question? It wasn't really my intention of opening this can of worms about what enlightenment is, because that's not something that I necessarily even am interested in. Like, maybe it's just, it's not well defined enough, whatever. It wasn't my point. It wasn't what I was really after.
Okay.
I'm willing to put out there a bunch of things that I think are good, like I said, kindness, patience, all those things. What I was trying to ask you was, let's say that through lots and lots of research, lots and lots of studies, experiments, we could find ways to increase those things. Like we discovered techniques that cultivate those qualities. Given that that's what you're in the business of doing as a Buddhist. Let's go down, some things worked, some things didn't. as a Buddhist, would you be willing to change? Like, say you found meditating in the forest really didn't work. It was just not a good way of developing those qualities. Would you be willing to just say, okay, the research has shown otherwise?
Yeah, sure, would of course. Change? Of course, yeah. And definitely.
So you wouldn't, as a Buddhist, you wouldn't object to, say, psychologists, you know, really just ripping into this stuff and testing it out?
No, of course not. Yeah, that's what they should be doing. That's their job. Yeah. I mean, maybe they'll come up with some kind of subliminal sound tape or something like that. You can do it. And they, you know, I don't know if you've seen this in spiritual magazines. They have these ads: meditate deeper than a Zen monk. Yeah.
But
See, the thing is, they didn't say which Zen monk. It might have been a Zen monk who had really bad meditation. But that, look, and I think in you know, in certain ways that empirical approach, you know, can be very useful and may well sort some things out and clarify certain kinds of things. And you know, generally speaking, as far as I'm aware, the literature and the research has very sort of strongly confirmed the effectiveness of meditation and various meditation techniques and things like that. I mean, I'll just give you one practical example, okay? In Buddhist meditation, there's a very well-known meditation technique from Burma called the Mahasi technique. Okay, and one of the key aspects of Mahasi technique is the technique of noting. So whenever anything happens in your mind, if you have a thought, then you note thinking, thinking, thinking. If you have a feeling in your arm, you note feeling, feeling, feeling. And you just sort of say those words to yourself in your mind. Now, other meditation teachers say you shouldn't note, right? They say you're just getting caught up in the concepts, that it's just creating more busyness in the mind, and that you should just be silently aware of things without noting them. Okay, so there's two different schools of thought in Buddhist meditation. Now that's something that there has been empirical research done, and what the empirical research found is that actually noting something is actually useful. It does actually calm the mind. It does actually clear kind of a sense of doubt and so on from the mind. So it does definitely, naming something has marked and measurable positive effects on the mind. And so I think that's something that doesn't mean to say that it's necessarily always the case. Yeah? Because it might, for example, be a question of different levels of meditation. At a certain, maybe a beginner's stage, noting is useful, but for an advanced meditator, maybe it's no point. Yeah? So it doesn't, you know, determine anything like that. But that's something which should be there as part of the debate.
But isn't it really the purpose of meditation in Buddhism to be kind and compassionate and have all these, you know, at least the virtues that she sort of pointed to? I thought that the main interest of Buddhism is to release yourself from your own suffering, completely irrelevant to all the side benefits that you can list. And in that sense, I don't understand. I don't understand what's the point of, you know, the business that you're in. I don't see you as being in the business of, you know, cultivating kindness and compassion and that kind of thing. So, I mean, the Buddha didn't say be kind, be compassionate. He says go to the forest, meditate, release yourself from suffering. That's what he said. He didn't, you know, all the other things are just beneficial side effects.
No, that's not true. He did say be kind and be compassionate all the time. Yeah, it's part of the path.
Yeah, but it's...
I mean, you're right in the sense of saying it's not the goal, kindness, yeah. It's not the goal, it's the path. It's the path, and so their qualities to be developed as part of the path. Yeah, the goal is liberation. But that's why... Sorry to interrupt, but come back to you in a minute. But that's why I said that, you know, that's why I didn't like the idea of sort of saying you're measuring enlightenment. I don't think you can. You can measure these qualities, and if you want to define that these are beneficial qualities, then that's fine. Sorry, Ben.
Yeah, I think in particular compassion is a essential component of propagating the teachings.
Uh-huh.
As if it wasn't the compassion of a Buddha,
yeah,
it wouldn't be any Buddhism.
That's
it
right.
Wouldn't be rebellious in silence. Yeah. A very useful means that spread the teachings and critical,
yeah,
very much rooted in compassion.
Bhante, if, for example, theoretically or psychologically, you know, we've been told that, okay, nirvana is the ultimate goal and it's the ultimate bliss or whatever. And then, okay, we think, okay, this is what we need to strive for. But there's also maybe the vagueness of the definition of the concept creates a sense of uncertainty. And what if you have this fear of going into the unknown and it's like a mystery? Okay, nirvana is mystery, so should I go there? Or maybe like when you're really faced with that kind of vagueness, and you know, there's a bit of this kind of inevitable fear of facing this unknown. It's like, what is it? And especially, for example, the last moment of life, you know, entering into the state of death, for example. Like, there's this unknown.
Well, it's unknown anyway.
But, yeah, but.
Well, again, that's where you take an empirical approach, yeah? Nibbana, essentially, Buddha said, is paramansukhang, is ultimate bliss. And that the reason why is because it comes from letting go. So the path of Buddhism is a path of letting go. And every little bit of letting go that we do, we can observe the effects of that. Yeah? So you let go of it just a tiny little bit, you can say, oh, you get a bit of happiness from that. Let go a bit more, you can say, well, I get a bit more happiness. And even the states of meditation that you can get into, you know, the states of peace of mind. You think, oh, well, I've let go of all my thoughts. I've let go of my worries of the past and future. Oh, my mind's so much more peaceful and happy now. Yeah, so maybe I can let go of even more. And so you keep on letting go little bit by little bit. And so at that final stage, then you let go, you sort of train yourself in letting go. And then at the final end, then you can let go completely. But what you say is still very true, that letting go is scary, and that's something that comes up time and time again, and you just have to keep on surmounting it.
How do you deal with the sense of being overwhelmed? If you, like, just say you're having rapid shift in consciousness or shift sort of to development or something like that, and it's a lot of fear? Because the
shifts are so rapid,
or, you know,
market,
or whatever.
What would
your advice be on coping?
Just, you know, go to sleep. No, seriously.
But then, in terms of processing it, though, so that you can actually keep going.
Yeah, just back off. Just back off. Have a bit of a rest, have a bit of a break, let your mind come back together, come back to normal, and then start again. And I'm really not kidding, and that is, actually, just in case you're wondering, that is an authentic piece of advice from the Thai Forest Tradition Masters as well. I've heard them say exactly the same thing. Yeah. So again, there's this kind of thing that, you know, you get from the Forest Tradition, that they've got to sit all night and force your way through pain and stuff like that. But actually, when you're talking to them, then they're very nuanced in things like that, you know. If you say, you know, things are getting too much and getting overwhelmed, just have a break, go and have a rest. Yeah.
So what do you mean by having a break?
Stop meditating, go to sleep. Have a good chat now. And,
Malaysia. Charles, one is asked a question about letting go. It sounds like a very passive process, but you see something you can, I think the term letting go feels like something you can just stop it. So that's like something that's a relief, something, you know, it's easy to do. But is there like any will or, I don't know, I just feel like it explained a bit more, like how do you, like, to let go of things that are bothering you. You know, it seems to me like it just requires a lot of discipline and awareness and things like that, but the term letting go sounds like it's just an easy thing to do. Does letting go also include, what if letting go is just such an obvious thing?
It's holding on. You know, your hand, yeah, has these muscles on it which actually enable you to hold things. And we have quite strong muscles that allow us to hold things quite strongly. And we've got muscles on the other side of the hand which enable us to let go. And those muscles are much weaker. The muscles we have for grabbing hold are strong. The ones we have for letting go are very weak. But still, even though they're much weaker, they're much more delicate. In a sense, they can't work without each other, can they? Because if you grab hold of something, and if you can't let go of it, then what are you going to do with your hands for the rest of your life? Right? So they have to come together. So letting go is actually an inherent and intrinsic part of grabbing hold. Right? But because the muscles in our mind, as in our hand, for grabbing hold are stronger than the ones for letting go, that's what we tend to pay attention to. Right? And we tend not to notice that muscle that we've had for letting go. Just give you an example. When you go to a restaurant, you look at the menu, you can look down, there's half a dozen dishes. Which one are you going to order? They all look delicious, right? And if you're anything like me, you'll think, well, I'll just order all of them and, do my best. But at the end of the day, no, you think that's too expensive. So you decide you've got to just order one of them, right? And so there's a grabbing hold of that one, yeah? And that's what you notice. At the same time, you're actually letting go of the other five. Yeah? But you don't notice that because you're only noticing the one you're grabbing hold of. Yeah? So actually that the two acts of grabbing hold of and letting go of, we're doing all the time. So the trick is to learn to pay attention to what we've let go of.
What about the difference between letting go and apathy and caring? Because you can, like Nilush is saying, there's something, a suggestion of it being passive. But you can say, oh, I've let go of that. I don't care. But actually, that's a sort of maybe the wrong attitude. That's a bit of actually resistance or bit of, Something
being negative anyway. Can be. So you just have to watch out for that. But it's kind of on the side of letting go, that's what the Buddha said. Disliking something, kind of on the side of letting go. There may be a bit of negativity and aversion. But at least you're not, getting too attached to it, so it's not too bad. One more question, when we finish up.
So if we want to let go of our suffering, we take hold of loving kindness.
Ah, very good, yes. Easy. But sometimes they give the simile, it's like climbing a ladder. So each step you go, you have to grab hold of the rung above and let go of the one below. So if you grab hold of both of them, you're stuck there. If you let go of both of them, you just fall in a pile at the bottom of the ladder. Okay, so one last.
If you say that one has to make aspiration to become a Buddha, he or she wants to become a Buddha, but is that actually a personal choice or it depends on tradition? The tradition didn't exist before Buddha's time, and so what actually happened? That Buddha became Buddha.
Crikey. Right. Well, very briefly, okay? Let me just, that's a very, very deep question and a very complex one if it requires a satisfactory answer. But if I was to simply give, without giving too much explanation, my own opinion on that is that the Buddha wasn't interested and didn't care about becoming a Buddha, wasn't part of what he was doing at all. He was interested in overcoming his defilements, overcoming his greed, hatred, and delusion, overcoming all of those things that were causing him suffering and leading him to cause harm for himself and for others. And the word Buddha, and when he'd done that, other people come along and start calling him Buddha. All right, whatever. It's not something he was sort of tried to get. Yeah, but it's something that is trying to understand life. You're trying to figure out an answer to these questions. As it says, the word I quoted earlier, King Kusala Govesi, literally means searching for an answer to the question, what is the good? Yeah, and so that's what he's doing. Yeah. Okay, so that's probably enough for this evening. And so we'll finish up by paying respects to the Triple Gem. And I believe there's some more items on the program for tomorrow, so we can see you then.
Patipanna